Hello, everyone. I'm the director of an arts company based in Glasgow called NVA. I've had about 21 years of practice. 30 years ago, I was just coming out of a phase of serial drug abuse and was working with five really intense young men from Scottish, Polish, English backgrounds, and we formed an industrial group called Test Department, who were based in the scrap yards of southeast London. We back then were recycling the waste products of that declining industrial era. Many of the places where we were getting our equipment from no longer exist, and we used to take really large bits of scrap metal, sometimes many tons in scale, and five of us would drum on that equipment. And we started with no skill, and after years of playing, we built up a very intense way of working together and a very intense form of live performance. And that came to fruition with the miners' strike. It was the point when some fairly random, abstract, artistic approaches to life found their focus, because it was a time when suddenly things became very real in the sense of what side were you on. It's funny, things don't feel black, white anymore. Maybe life feels more complex, but somehow in the mid-80s, it really didn't feel like very complex. Thatcher and what she represented and the ferocity of that attack on working life in Britain was so overwhelming that for a lot of us, it really brought things into focus. And we toured throughout the UK raising money for the miners. We put together the South Wales Striking Miners Choir, where three competitive choirs joined together, choirs which had police in them, as well as striking miners. You can imagine what that meant within those communities. And we worked with a really hardcore young Kent miner, Alan Sutcliffe, who never went back after the strike and joined us for 2 years and became a vocalist. And the reason I'm giving this as an intro is that we're going to be the first work on the stage. By complete chance, the AV Festival this year have asked Test Department to reform in order to make to mark the moment of the miners' strike. And we've made a film documenting that time of struggle and doing a new soundtrack which will be actually projected onto the stage, and the audience will come in boats to watch that work. That's at the end of March, so if any of you are around, I'd highly recommend, just as an extension or as a sideways aspect to this program, to come and see that piece of work. Alan was a remarkable poet in many ways, and he described, I remember him very clearly saying within the strike, that the only time that working people have control of their own destiny is when they're in struggle. And it always stuck with me. It's often the point when you're actually taking control, when you're on strike, because the end results often end up in failure. But in that year, people took control of their own destiny, and they made their own networks, and they survived through massive financial hardship. And I suppose that's the starting point for what I'm going to talk about now, which is I'm now a different person. I'm not as angry, but I still make work that I hope has as much focus as what we did 30 years ago. And for the last 6 years, I've been involved in a particular battle to save what's been known as the greatest modernist ruin in the UK, which is a place called St. Peter's Seminary, built by Gillespie Kyd Coyer, two remarkable modernist architects, Izzy Metstein, who died last year, and Andy McMillan. Both were stalwarts of the MAC. They've produced many of Scotland's finest architects have come through their hands in the 70s and 80s into the early 90s. And they built this remarkable building, which I'm going to talk about a bit this morning. It's a very hard narrative to express in 15 minutes. So, and today the focus is community and sustainability. I'll try and give you a little flavor of how we've approached the resuscitation of this building. Position. Any of you who know Glasgow know that this Great Western Road, and it whisks you out up to Loch Lomond. Most people, 90% of people who come to Scotland, head straight up that motorway and head up to the Highlands. But if you take a little step to the west, you come along the Firth of Clyde. And along there is Dumbarton, which was the original seat of Scottish kings in the 8th century. So it's an amazing historic landscape, completely undervalued. Very few people go and visit that point, but it's a remarkable lump of rock with a very strong ritual history to say about that area. And just further along is Cardross. And at the back of Cardross is these old woodlands, and contained within them is a remarkable piece of built and unbuilt environment. The built story of that landscape, it's 144-acre semi-ancient woodland. Two gorges come together, running from the northeast and the northwest, and set within the middle of them was Kilmeehugh House, which was a classic Scottish baronial house and a grand Victorian estate. It also contained an older 15th century castle. It was built around about the 1860s and was a fairly typical Scottish country estate. And then in the 1940s, the Archdiocese of Glasgow bought that site. And it was a time of expansion for Gillespie-Cade Coyer, who'd done a lot of church buildings in Scotland and had brought these two young architects into their practice. So Andy McMillan and Nitty Metstein were the young Turks coming through, and they were given, through the patronage of one remarkable, very much an aesthete, Bishop of Dumbarton, allowed them reign to create this absolute remarkable intervention. An intervention that you might expect to see in an urban setting, but this was literally dropped onto this plinth in the middle of this remarkable, classic romantic setting. And the juxtaposition was that they literally wrapped the form of this building around the baronial house. They didn't attempt to smooth the relationship between the 19th and 20th centuries. They collided them. They juxtaposed them in the most dramatic form. And the building itself was interesting that they created a ziggurat form, the ziggurat containing the cells where the young priests stayed, and each year you were there, you were allowed to go one floor up, so you were closer to heaven, theoretically. And that shape then created two vast voids within the main block, and within those voids were a refectory and a very particular chapel. And you can see from this picture that juxtaposition of form, and you can obviously see really direct influences from Le Corbusier. But it's not a copy. It's a building that has its own remarkable inventiveness. And while it picks on very obvious aspects of modernism, what it does with it takes it, I think, into very new directions. This is the teaching block, which forms the L shape, if you like, around the where the baronial house stood. It's elevated out, or almost more like a Frank Lloyd Wright gesture. And a lot of this work, you know, if you look at the pylons that are holding this up, it's on the same level of industry as a motorway, and yet paradoxically, all the forms feel as if they're floating. And this is one of the beauties of it, is it has that sort of industrial monumentality and physical presence and heaviness. But when you're within the structures, you feel as if you're within floating structures. And that paradox is again, one of the unique features of this particular building. You can see here from the outside, you have this very classic accommodation block that you would see in sort of student accommodation, I think, throughout a lot of universities in Britain throughout the 60s and 70s, but at the top in the middle you can see this very strange little ziggurat roof light, and that was a bespoke element that sat over the chapel and above the concrete altar, and it meant that light was modulated. If you imagine that's facing south, and as the sun was at its fullest height, It would cast light down on the rare day that we have full sunshine in Scotland. It would cast light down through refracting the light and breaking it up into geometric lines, which then ran down through the floating beams above the altar. So actually, as you sat within Mass, these forms would slowly move across the floor within the duration of Mass. And that really sums up one of the deep qualities of this building, is that it never functioned. You used to say you go to a Gillespie Kidd Choir church with a bucket, and it wasn't for the collection, it was to catch the water. It never functioned as a building. The heating never functioned. It was, in the end, a place which was built for 109 students, and when it closed 13 years after its opening date in 1966, there were 27 students, and they were all living back in the baronial house. And yet, many of them will talk about the quality of light in Mass. And so it's almost like there was this sort of hidden gem within this bastardized outer form. And you can actually see here also that there are these strange little silos, and these represent, you can almost see it's like the hands holding the building. And these are the side chapels where the young priests would stand with their back to the altar, so while they were learning how to perform the theatre of the Mass, they would have their backs and they would be performing themselves in these side chapels. So it's an absolutely remarkable mixture of form and function. The inside was very simple, mostly using wooden panelling and concrete. And this is how it looks now. And this is how it's looked for 25 years. It has defied every single attempt to rescue it. It's become one of the classic ruins. It's a place that's attracted graffiti artists from around the world, and architectural students from around the world have come to pay homage here. My God, I've got 5 minutes left. Sorry, this is not going to work as a talk. It's a much longer talk. I'm going to have to conduit this very fast. It's attracted an international community who've come to it and found it, even though it's very off the beaten track. But locally, it's been hated. I mean, there are many people who've said, I'd like to put a bomb under this and blow it up. And so I think we realized that there were very different communities who had very different ownerships or non-ownerships of this site. To people who lived in the local village, it's a place where bad things have happened for 20 years. To other people, it's a place where you come and you can do your own creative work, a liminal space, a place that allows people to feel creative, a place that is unofficial, a place where you feel illegal when you come through there. As our approach, traditional regeneration has failed with this building. Three planning applications have been rejected. So what happens when a small independent arts practice says we have a different model of regeneration that accepts the ruination and gives it value and therefore does not seek to turn this back to what it was in a traditional renovation or restoration model, but only seeks to bring back what it might use effectively in the future and actually allow the ruination to continue and simply manage that ruination. And that's been our approach, and that's now attracted £5.5 million towards a £7.5 million first phase. So it's actually working. So there's an interesting model here where an artist-led practice is creating a new form of generation. I don't call it regeneration, it's generation, because our model really says that in the last 30 years this has slowly declined, and we have an iterative creative process that can slowly allow it to come back to life and to explore what it is in this condition. How we've worked with community is very particular. We never told anyone they were wrong because they hated it. In fact, if anything, we just sought to articulate that anger. Anger is a useful emotion. And it, of course, what people are expressing in their anger is a desire for change. And we've worked with that quite closely. The first thing we did was to create a new map of the site that again allowed people to read things which weren't normally valued within the site. And we created open days. A lot of old villages used to do the marching of the bounds, where you would walk around the outskirts of a village in order to mark the shape of it. And we sort of marched the bounds. And we opened the site back up, put in temporary bridges, and gave people the opportunity to for it to become theirs again. We then set up the Invisible College, which was a research network, much like this network here today. And within that, we had academics, communities of interest from around the world, planners, politicians, and then a quarter of that had to be local community. And the idea was that no knowledge should be privileged within that. So, for example, an academic who has a 30-year experience in modernist architecture does not have more to say than someone who's lived there for 30 years. They simply have a different perspective onto that site. And that we could reflect that in a very informal way through creating these open activity days on the site. It's still owned by the Archdiocese. They've donated it to us, but it's so profoundly dangerous as a site, we won't take it off them until we've got the full funding. But one of the things we did, it's very important to get people back into places and to get them working again. So we negotiated that local people would have the right to grow food on the site again. And we opened up the walled gardens, we cleared them, and for 2 years, people grew food on the site again, and with absolutely no support. I made a point of saying, you're going to do this on your own. You're going to carry your own tools onto site. You're going to manage your own key. We just put in a simple, big unit for people to lock tools into. But it would be a self-managed project. It may not last forever, but it's the first step for you taking control back of this landscape. And that worked very well until a kid, nothing to do with us, but a kid came around the back of the walled garden. The roof fell in on him from an outbuilding. His shoulder was crushed. And the church then just completely locked the site down again. And because we won't take ownership, because it is too dangerous, and we will only do very specific elements of access that we can control, the whole site is shut down. The community has completely lost access. So that's the reality of what happens within those negotiations. It doesn't mean they won't get access again later on, but the point was I set it up in a way that said this may not be forever, and you have to accept that you get these little moments when you can move things forward, then you have to step back. Now it's about fundraising and about something different. Okay, I'm going to short circuit because I know I'm about to run out of time. The reason why I've referenced this is that the only element of restoration that we're going to do on this is to bring back the element above the chapel and to create a wind and watertight space and to reinvest that magic into the sanctuary area, which we're going to use as a performance space. There's a very clear reason to do that, in the sense that I wanted to have this idea of a beating heart within this skeletal form. So where there is entropy and death and loss, and very much that idea of an inside-outside space where nature does take part, nature takes back parts of the building, you then create this one vibrant, controlled space that is, in a sense, regenerating with the art and the culture that you bring into it. The reference here, and I think it's been referenced this morning as well, is a humble architecture. It's humble architecture is a phrase that was first used by Lino Bobardi. He's a remarkable Italian architect who ended up in Brazil. Many of you may know her. And she was one of the first people to reuse industrial space. The Centro Pompeia in Sao Paulo is this incredible building with vast silos heading up into space. And for example, so we don't have air conditioning, so she just punched massive holes into the walls of the center, and it's a beautiful, radical reuse of space. And she called that a humble architecture. And in a way, our approach is, I think, the same. It's the idea, reuse what is there, reuse it with imagination, and in a sense, just accept that things should change very slowly. It doesn't have to be fast steps. You know, the vision for something may take many, many years to unfold. And just be open and bring people along the way with you. And don't do it as a process. Often art is sort of treated like some kind of homogeneous sticking plaster, like it's going to make everything better. It's going to heal everything. It's going to bring the social fabric back into society. I mean, that art mostly just makes things more complex, and it makes our reading of the world more complex, and it allows people to make connections that perhaps were always there but haven't been articulated for a while. So I suppose my plea is that it's good that people disagree about something like the staves. Some people will own it in a very historic political way. For other people, it's blocking their view onto the time. For other people, it represents a creative potential. And all of those opinions are valid. And nothing should attempt to erase the difference. It's actually it's the conflict that makes it interesting. And it's authentic. And it's got real history. And it's history built on real effort and real struggle. I've had my 20 minutes. Thanks very much.